So mostly all that, I think some are missing. First of all, I noticed that only 17 comments, I mean 17, actually it's not even 17 because two of them wrote twice. So there are only 15 people took time to answer the mandatory question. So remember I told you how to get a bad grade in this course? That's one of them. If you cannot find time to do the one required thing, in fact, as of yesterday night, it was still 12. And those of you who haven't done it way before yesterday night, you should still try to do it faster. And in fact, you can get a lot more interactive discussions if you use this the communication tool. I also noticed that so this is about 15 people. So in fact, I would know who did not write, this stuff by, this is the Blogspot, so it I'm sure has the timestamp. So I would be able to tell who actually took time to do the minimum required things. The one that I was hoping, also other people, more people will spend time on, that didn't quite happen, is the other question. Well, there's some new thing I didn't notice yet, which is these questions, and only four comments on that. If you cannot be bothered to speak your mind when your grade doesn't depend on it, then I'm not quite sure when you will speak up, okay? So try to express your views, try to answer these questions and so on, okay? Any questions before we start? That's not mandatory. The one that's mandatory, only 15 people did. And the one that's not mandatory, only I think 3 people did. But as I told you, we can take this cynically and you can all just basically waste this class time and I'll do it too, or we can actually make something of it. And it's up to you, okay? It'll be useful if you try to take this slightly more seriously. Okay, one thing I did notice is a whole bunch of you said security is the reason why you got into computer science. That's sort of depressing to me because I don't care that much about security. So rather than I teach you about security, I'll try to get an expert on security for one of the classes. I'll try, okay? It's important to listen to an area from people who are actually passionate about it, and you may still not be passionate after hearing them. But if I were to tell you about security, you'll lose interest, and I'm not particularly interested in doing that. Okay, that's one thing that lots of people seem to be interested in. We will probably, as I said, try to get someone to speak on that. As I said, I also will get some students to come and some of the old ASU undergrad students who are still around, either as seniors or as grad students, to come by sometime, and in case you have any questions for them, as to how do you succeed in ASU, you can ask them too. That's the other thing we'll do. Today, what I did was, what I'm going to do is talk about complexity. And that sort of starts from the questions that we had last class, and we'll use that as the starting point and think of what does it mean to talk about a problem being hard to solve in computer science, and why is P equal to NP such a big deal, okay? What I will teach you here is really kind of an overview, and it crosses about 3 or 4 different courses. So you will get whatever you get out of this, and hopefully when you hear it again in the specific courses, it'll actually all make sense for you more. But also it's good to know when you're writing programs, are you trying to solve a problem which has a easy solution but you are making it hard, or is it in fact a hard problem? And so the fact that your program is running slow is not a surprise because nobody's program would run any faster. Okay, so that's something that we will talk about. Before I do that, are there any questions? Any other questions? Okay. So this is basically, so P equal to NP is something that was one of the, that was the CS theorem that somebody said they proved, and you know, people were actually talking about this, you know, in the news articles and so on and so forth. I think some of the people, I think a couple of people who answered the block question remember, knew this. How many of you have heard P equal to NP problem? Okay, the rest of you are going to hear about it today. Okay, and those of you who already heard about it, hopefully you will learn something more about why it's an important problem. Okay, okay, so let's revisit some of the questions from the last time. The first question I asked, one of the questions I asked about computer programming is, how many pairwise comparisons do I need to do to check if a sequence of n numbers is sorted? So I have a sequence of n numbers, and I want to check if it is sorted or not. And so one way I can do it is I can essentially, you know, start with the first number, compare it to the next number, and then if that succeeds, then compare it to the, you know, the second number is compared to the third number, and so on. Right? The question is, how many such comparisons do you need to do to actually certify that the sequence is sorted? And we talked about this. You're looking extremely surprised. I guess a lot happened since last Friday. But we talked about this last Friday. And in the worst case, you have to do n-1 comparisons. Okay. In fact, to certify that the sequence is sorted, you can't do any less. Okay. But to certify that the sequence is not sorted, you can get by with just one comparison. Because if the first two numbers are already in the wrong order, then they cannot be sorted anymore. Right? Okay. So that was one question we talked about. Next question I asked you was, if this, you write this, this question, answer to this question as a little program. So this program takes a sequence and says yes if it is sorted and no if it's not sorted. Okay. Can I write a program around this program that will take an arbitrary sequence and make it sorted? Remember, this one is only testing whether a sequence is sorted. Right? Okay? What I want to do is take any arbitrary sequence and output a sequence made up of those same numbers, but it's now in sorted order. Okay? One way you could do this, and the version that I was asking you to think about is the following, which is, since ultimately the sorted sequence is going to be a permutation of the original sequence, right? And if you have n things, then you have to reorder them. How many ways can you reorder them? This is elementary combinatorics and permutations, actually, from your, I guess, I don't know, algebra 1 or something. So if I have to place 4 people in a row, how many different ways can I place those 4 people? 4 factorial, because in the first place, any of the 4 can sit. In the second place, any of the remaining 3 can sit. The third place, any of the remaining 2 can sit. In the last place, the last one has to sit. So 4 times 3 times 2 times 1, it's 4 factorial, right? So what I could do is I could generate all n factorial permutations, and for each permutation, check if it is sorted. Okay, I'll put a loop around my check, and then whenever whenever this program says yes, it's sorted, I say, hey, I won. Here is the sorted sequence. I'm done. And my question I was asking you to think about is this a reasonable way to write sorting programs? No. Why not? It takes too long. Okay. So here is a problem where you actually know that this is already pretty bad. It takes too long. Okay. But why are you so sure? Suppose I were to ask you, you know, sorting seems to be a particular type of property that you understand. Suppose I make some arbitrary property that a sequence of numbers must satisfy. okay, a permutation of the sequence of numbers must satisfy. Then if I give you a sequence, then in the worst case, you really will have to look at all n factorial sequences to see if any one of them satisfies the problem, the property I have in mind. Do you understand what I'm saying? Suppose, in fact, instead of being sorted, I have, you know, something like I give you a sequence of letters, okay, and I'm making, I want it to spell a particular word. Right? Now, in that case, well, maybe that's the only one way of spelling that word, you know, one order in which all the letters will spell that particular word. In that case, you really do have to look at all permutations and find if any of them actually spells that word. Agreed? Okay, so what I'm trying to say is you already start having, you have some intuition about sorting. You somehow think it should be easier to do than doing n factorial permutations. Okay, in general, actually, the reason you can do it easier is related to something that I mentioned last class, which is sorting is the kind of property where if it is broken locally, then you know it cannot be restored. So if you started looking at a sequence and then the first two numbers are already in the wrong order, then you don't have to waste your time looking at the rest of the numbers. Okay? And so the efficient sorting algorithm, how many of you know something about how to write a sorting program? It's okay if you don't know, okay? I mean, you know, we are supposed to teach you all this stuff anyway again, but some of you probably know sorting. You know, there are, what names of sorting algorithms do you know? Do you know any names? Bubble sort, quick sort, selection sort. In fact, there's a guy called Knuth. How many of you know the name Knuth? Okay, this is, imagine that this is also a class where you learn a whole bunch of buzzwords that you can drop to make people think you're in computer science. Okay, Knuth is a pretty well-known computer scientist. He actually is behind many of the very good algorithms in computer science, and he also wrote. By the way, how many of you know LaTeX? Okay, LaTeX is a text processing software. You can write, you know, all mathematical-looking papers in LaTeX. Okay, Knuth actually, in fact, invented LaTeX, and he's the kind of the guy who, one point of time, he decided, you know, many years back, that he needs to write a series of books talking about the fundamentals of computer science, and so he started a series of books called Art of Computer Programming. Okay, and he wrote volume 1, volume 2, volume 3, and he was going to write up to volume 8, but then, you know, it's highly mathematical, you know, text, right? So he was getting sick and tired of writing this, giving it to his publisher, and they will mistype everything, and so he has to look over them and correct all the, mistakes in the mathematical typesetting. So he said, I'll just take a little bit of time off and invent a much better mathematical typesetting software. And he actually wound up taking a lot of time off, and he invented LaTeX, which has revolutionized mathematical typesetting. Okay, so he's that kind of a guy. So he has somewhat of a bigger brain than is absolutely needed to get by day to day. And one of his books on Art of Computer Programming, one whole volume is sorting. Just one whole volume is sorting. So if you know three names, you can only imagine how do you fill that thick a book with different sorting algorithms. Okay, the bigger point that I want you to understand, it's not as important to understand every little separate sorting algorithm. What I want you to understand is the way sorting becomes more efficient is the way this is actually very inefficient is that you are generating a potential solution and checking if that solution is correct. And then generating one more, checking if it is correct. And the generate and test are disconnected. Do you understand what I'm saying? So if this guy said 7, suppose I'm supposed to do this in the increasing order, and I gave a sequence which is 4, 8, and my test said no. My test said no. Then you may very well ask 729485. That will still be no. Right? You didn't learn anything from the testing guy yelling at you. In your own program, your generator did not learn anything from the testing program yelling at you. So if you think in terms of a design philosophy for writing more efficient algorithms, efficient programs, one idea you want to remember is really intelligence is putting the test part of generate and test into the generate part. Now those of you as and when you actually learn sorting, or those of you who know something about sorting, try to understand why this actually makes sense when the when the actual sorting algorithms you write sort of interleave testing and generation. Okay? Which is in essence how they wind up improving their efficiency. Now, if you do this, you can improve efficiency, but there could be problems where in fact there is nothing you can do. Even with all your smart ideas, it will still take all n factorial permutations to be computed and, you know, seen if one of them is the solution. Okay, so the problem itself can be hard. So there are two ways you can fail, right? One is the problem itself is hard and you're stuck with it, and the other is you are not smart enough. The problem is easy, you made it harder in writing your program. Okay, and that's sort of what we will try to understand in terms of talking about complexity. Is the problem really hard? And if it's not hard, how do we write efficient algorithms? If it is hard, how do we realize that it's hard? Do any of you know the following, I think it's sort of a religious biblical quote, it's some sort of a prayer to some kind of a Lord. Lord, grant me the wisdom to change the parts that I can change. I'm messing up the exact wording. I'll find it out for you a little later. Change the parts that I can change, and essentially live with the parts that I can't change, and the wisdom to know the difference. It's an extremely important point. Okay, if you want, if there are parts of the world that you can change and you give up, then nothing is going to change. And there's the parts of the world that don't change, and you're wasting your time trying to change it. You're wasting your time. And of course, the wisdom is figuring out which is which. And that's the kind of wisdom we're looking in computer science too. You know, if the problem is actually not hard, give me computer science background so that I can write efficient algorithms. If it is hard, give me computer science background so that I'll find some approximation algorithm. And to call myself a computer science person, give me the wisdom to tell the difference so that I won't unnecessarily write approximation algorithm for sorting programs, because sorting is actually an easy problem. Okay, so that's sort of what we are trying to learn in complexity. Okay, so now that's ultimately related to the CS theorem about P equal to NP. Okay, and to think about that, let's think about this. So exactly when do you say an algorithm is slow? Some people already said n factorial is too hard. Okay, why is that supposed to be slow? How do we actually say that a computation is slow? You can say, well, you know, I mean, I started the computing program, I went to have a coffee, then went to have lunch, then went to have dinner, and it's still not done. Okay, and so that could be slow. But can we talk about more formal ways of saying that a program, an algorithm, is actually taking too much time? A computation is taking too much time. Okay, so you kind of basically from behind in the class you said n factorial times n is a bit too much of a complexity for sorting problem, right? Because n factorial permutations times each sequence has to be checked whether it's sorted or not, that's another n comparisons. So in the dumb idea that I came up with, n factorial times n comparisons will be done finally to give you a sorted sequence. Okay, that looked like that's too much. Okay, those of you who know sorting, you said you knew sorting. So what is the actual approximate complexity of good sorting algorithms? You don't know. Okay, so it turns out, does anybody know? So we know that n factorial times n is too much. Okay, if n is the number of numbers that you're trying to sort, n factorial times n is too much. What is the best anybody is able to do? And it turns out that it's pretty darn easy to get an n square algorithm. Very easy to get an n square algorithm. You know, the way you'll get an n square algorithm, it turns out, is the following. Look at the sequence, find the, suppose you're trying to do from the smallest to the largest. First, look at the sequence, find the smallest number. Put it in the first place. Then remaining sequence, find the next smallest number. Put it in the second place and do this. Okay, that's essentially one way of doing it, and that turns out being n square complex. Okay, but in fact, sorting can be done in O n log n complexity. So it's less than n square. N times log n is much less than n square, right? Because n is much less than log of n. I'm sorry, n is much higher than log of n. Okay. That's fine. So it turns out that n log n is, you know, is you can do sorting in n square, but there are other problems that might take n cube time in the amount of input. And by the way, the complexity of a problem has to depend somehow on the size of the input. So for example, even if you have the best sorting algorithm, if you're trying to sort three numbers, you take less time than if you're trying to sort 3 million numbers. Agreed? I mean, it shouldn't, you should not be surprised that if you have to run a bigger instance, you're taking more time. Okay? So complexity is always thought of in terms of the size of the input. Okay? And so the question is, if n is a number of is a sequence of numbers, n square is, you know, n is good, O of n is good. Okay? The cheapest way to solve a problem is doing one comparison of some sort. So it's, you know, order constant time. That's the cheapest. Then order log of n. That's even, you know, slightly harder, but, you know, still cheap. N square, n cube, n power 4, n power 2785. Okay? Where do we draw the line? Where do we say that problems are hard to solve? If they are taking n square, if they're taking n cube, they're taking n power 2755, okay, that's where you need to understand the one nightmare every computer science person must have. So if you ever think of this next thing that I'm going to show you in your dream, you have to wake up sweating. Okay, really, really important. Okay, and it'll come all sorts of places, and when you see that number, you know, any self-respecting computer scientist must wake up sweating. Okay, what is it? 2 power n. 2 power n are essentially k power n, you consider that to be hard. Okay? So in some sense, the difference is these are all, remember from your algebra, these are all what? Polynomials in n. N power, a constant, is a polynomial in n. 2 power n is an exponential function in n. So n just traded places from being in the base to being in the exponent. Okay? Now, why are we more afraid of 2 power n than n power 3955? In fact, I can argue that for small values of n, for small values, for reasonably small values of n, if I draw n here, okay, n power 3755 might be going very fast, going up very fast. Okay? And you may actually see that 2 power n in earlier parts of the n might actually is lower than n power 3755. The beauty, of course, is as n increases, eventually this thing will overtake n power any number. Do you guys get what I'm saying? It's early in the morning and no donuts and all that, but you know, ultimately the reason exponents give you heartache, headache, nightmares is because as you keep increasing the size of the input, at some point of time an exponential function will overtake the largest polynomial function. And in fact, the opposite is true as to why you love logarithms. The reason you love logarithms is if you consider log n versus n power minus n power, let's say 1 over 10,000. It's again the same thing. N power 1 over 10,000 seems to be raising very slowly with respect to n, right? Okay, and yet log of n will eventually fall below n power 1 over 10,000. So logarithmic complexities are good because they are smaller than pretty much any fractional powers of n. Okay? And similarly, exponential complexities are bad because they are going to overtake pretty much any polynomial complexity of n. Yes, sir. Every one of them. All polynomials would be overtaken by an exponential function. It's just a question of how long we're going to live. Okay. Now, interesting thing is, even as I'm saying this, you know, this whole discussion essentially assumes that as n is increasing, 2 power n eventually will overtake any, polynomial problem. Polynomial complexity problem, So in some sense, you will start encountering instances where your friend's polynomial time algorithm is doing faster than your exponential time algorithm. But what if this only happens? Let's say there is a very well known problem that you might hear about later, but it's used pretty much everywhere, called linear programming. Actually, one sad thing for you guys, unfortunately, is my son is in 9th grade, and so I kind of know what you guys do in high school. Okay, so I do know that in algebra 3, 4, and free calculus, you do linear programming. What's linear programming? It's given a set of linear constraints on a certain set of variables, saying x1 plus 2x5 minus x3 must be less than or equal to 15, x2 plus x7 must be less than or equal to 7, given these kinds of constraints, and an objective function that you're trying to optimize, x1 plus 7x2 plus 3x5. What is the values of x1, x2, x3 that will optimize this? This is a problem that's used all over the place. Like airlines will try to use this to figure out how to optimize, flight assignment given the number of people traveling from places to places, for example. Okay, and linear programming is a classic case. The reason I brought that up is there is an algorithm for linear programming called Simplex, which you might hear about. Mr. Hemingway, get rid of those things, please. Okay? You are welcome to leave the class anytime, but if you're here, you're going to pay attention to me. Okay? And as I said, I do have your faces, and that's not a good thing to do in the class. Okay? Unless you are actually trying to send a mail to George Danzig, who actually invented Simplex algorithm, to ask him his opinion about what I'm saying. Okay? It turns out that Simplex algorithm actually takes exponential time. Okay? And yet, for most practical instances, it turns out to be faster than the quote-unquote polynomial time algorithms for linear programming. So this is possible, that sometimes your friend's polynomial time algorithm is slower than your exponential time algorithm for small values of n, or the values of n that you seem to actually see in practice. But all we are saying is, as civilization progresses and you're trying to solve larger and larger instances, you will eventually be overtaken by any polynomial. And you will be overtaking your friend's complexity because you're exponential. Okay, so that's where we draw the line. 2 power n is where we draw the line. And now the question, of course, is, so if I see a problem for which the best way I can solve that problem seems to be exponential, that is 2 power n, then I would say it's a hard problem to solve. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay. Now, this is an iffy definition, because if you did not know anything about sorting and I told you this particular program as a sorting program, and you look at it and say, yeah, that's obviously n factorial is exponential. Essentially, it's close to exponential. Right? Because n factorial is 1 times, 2 times, etc., up to n. And that's a little less than n times n times n times n up to up to n, which is n power n. Okay, so factorials are close to exponential. Okay, so the question, of course, is, if you start this as the program for sorting, you might think sorting is a hard problem. And that doesn't make it a hard problem. Just because I don't know how to solve the problem doesn't mean it's a hard problem. There may be other people who know how to solve it better. So how can we tell if problems are truly hard? Okay. One idea is to think of the classes P and NP, and in particular, think of the following thing. Suppose you're trying to find a solution to a problem. Now, you are so lucky, your rich uncle or your doting aunt came, put the solution in a plate and gave it to you. You just want to check whether it's a solution or not. You didn't have to produce it. All you need to do is check whether it's a solution. Suppose checking whether or not it's a solution is going to take exponential time. Then clearly there is no way you can solve this problem in less than exponential time. Do you guys get my point? Okay, so it's one thing, even when the checking of the solution can be done in polynomial time, you may still have to do exponential amount of work. Sorting is a case in point where checking whether a sequence is sorted or not can be done in polynomial time, and if you are silly, you can write an exponential algorithm for it. Okay, but if it requires exponential time to check whether the solution is correct, then you could potentially not be able to solve that problem in polynomial time. Now, my question is, are there problems where the problem is so hard, that if I give you the solution, just checking that it is correct takes you exponential amount of time in the size of the solution? Okay? Do any of you know of such problems? It's okay if you don't, but I'll tell you one, one more very famous problem in computer science, and that has that property. And there are many, many such problems, but I'll give you a canonical example of a problem where checking whether the solution is correct itself takes exponential time. Now, before I go there, let me tell you the classes P and NP. A class P is all the problems which actually have polynomial time solution. And for them to have a polynomial time solution, it only means that somebody knows how to write a polynomial time solution for this. You may yourself not know because you just started writing a program. In fact, one of the funniest things is when people are in the throes of programming in the industry, oftentimes they are, without realizing, writing exponential algorithms to polynomial problems, because they just didn't know any better and they just needed to get done, very quickly do some programming, and sometimes you'll wind up writing inefficient programs. Okay, all I care if for a problem to be in the class P is that I do know a solution for that problem. Existence proof. There exists one solution that will solve it in polynomial time. Class NP, on the other hand, is all the problems. Class NP, on the other hand, is all the problems where checking the solution's correctness can be done in polynomial time. I don't tell you anything about how long it will take to solve the problem itself. Okay? Now, it's easier to check whether a problem is in class NP because I give you a solution and you need to think of how long it will take to check the correctness of the solution. Okay, so many problems are essentially in class NP because they're all problems where if I give you the solution, figuring out whether it's the solution will take polynomial time. Okay, it's also the case that problems that are in class P are also in class NP, because if you can both generate the solution and test its correctness in polynomial time, it must be the case that testing the correctness is also polynomial. And so P is already in NP. Okay? So the picture you have in mind, right now is, I can draw a nice little Venn diagram. Here is the class of problems which are called NP. These are all the problems where if I give you the solution to check whether it's correct or not, you'll take exponential time. Okay? And then there is some set P, which is sort of within NP, hopefully, which is certainly within NP. It's definitely within NP, because every polynomial problem is also an NP problem. And these have, we know that they have algorithms that can solve them in polynomial time. The main question that P equal to NP asks is it true that this is the picture? Or is it really the case, unbeknownst to you, is it really the case that NP and P are the same set? Okay? Now, it's a tricky question because the only way you can show that something is not polynomial is you can show that something is polynomial by actually providing an example algorithm that solves that problem in polynomial time. How do you show that it cannot be solved in polynomial time even though it is class NP? How do you do that? In fact, to get there, I'll skip over the next slide and go to this part. Okay? So how do you prove that you have a problem in NP and you try to solve, write a program for it, and it's taking exponential time? You just want to tell your boss, and it's taking time to solve, so you want to tell your boss, you know, this thing is pretty hard problem, and because I spent as much as 3 hours solving it, and I have taken CSE 101, and you know, I'm unable to get a better algorithm for this. Okay, so then when you go to your boss and say, you know, here is an NP problem that's still hard, because my algorithm for solving that problem seems to take exponential time, okay, then you are arguing with your boss and saying, I can't find an efficient algorithm. Either you trust me or think that I'm dumb and just hire somebody else. Okay? A better thing would be to be able to say, I can't find an efficient algorithm, and by God, it's not possible. Here's a mathematical proof. Okay, and that you can do, I'll tell you in a minute, of a class of problems which are not in NP. That means checking whether the solution is correct will take exponential time. And in that case, nobody can solve that problem in less than exponential time. Okay, if you can show that your problem is not even in NP, then it's going to take more than polynomial time. I mean, it's going to take exponential time. And so you proved it. But unfortunately, most interesting problems do fall in NP. And yet you don't know whether or not, and you sometimes wind up writing an algorithm, it's exponential, you have this doubt, is it really the case that this NP problem won't have a polynomial solution, or is it that I should take some more graduate level courses and see if I can solve it in polynomial time? Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay, so this part I will tell you in a minute, a problem which actually has this property that nobody, there is a proof that this problem cannot be solved in polynomial time because its solution is, checking the solution correctness itself is exponential. Okay, these are called probably intractable problems, and they are above class NP, they are outside of class NP. Okay, now if you are in NP, which are large number of useful problems, then the best you can do to your boss is this. I can't find a good solution, but neither do any of all these famous people. Okay? And none of these people are able to prove, none of these people are able to come up with any, you know, easy solutions for this, any polynomial time solutions. So don't think I'm dumb. Nobody else is actually able to find it either. Now, this is not a mathematical proof because a superior form of intelligence coming from Mars might still solve this problem. Okay, and right now, until you know whether or not P and NP have this structure, the best you can ever do for class NP problems is this. That, you know, other smart people are unable to find any polynomial time solutions for this. So, you know, yeah, if you want, go ahead and fire me, but you're not going to get any better guy. That's the best you can do. Okay, we'll come back to this in a minute, but let me go to the problem, one problem which we know for sure is hard. It's for sure hard. Okay, and this is the Tower of Hanoi problem. How many of you have heard of this? Yes, okay. So here's the Tower of Hanoi problem. Actually, when you were kids, you may have, you know, been given, at least actually my kid had it, and it's not because I'm in CS. Somebody gave it to him. These are discs like this, and there are three pegs. Okay, and the game is to put all these discs onto this third peg. But the only moves you're allowed to do is to move one disc at a time. You can lift a disc, put it on the different peg. Okay? In the end, you want all the disks to be here. And you can see the disks are having this pyramidal shape. That's by definition. That's actually part of the problem. Disks all have differing sizes. Okay? And you would then put all the disks back again in the same pyramidal shape. Okay? And you only get to pick one at a time. And you're given an extra peg just in case. And you think, why do I need an extra peg? Well, this is a trick. The problem is that if you ever, not even for a microsecond, put two disks on top of each other, such that the larger disk is on top of the smaller disk, the world ends. And the world ending is actually connected to the idea of Tower of Hanoi. The legend has it that different cultures have, surprisingly enough, this legend. I mean, this has been called Tower of Hanoi, and there is even a Hanoi Tower, Hanoi in Vietnam. This looks a lot of like a Tower of Hanoi right now, right? And there's also a version I heard, Tower of Brahma, which is, you know, and all of these have this following statement that a bunch of sacred priests have been given, you know, a set of sacred disks and three sacred pegs, and they're solving this problem. Okay, and they're obviously chanting and all that fun stuff. And if they by mistake put a large disk on top of a small disk, Earth ends. And if as and when they succeed and put all the disks onto the final disk, a final peg, Earth will still end because we have succeeded in solving the world's problem, and then Earth will end. And the good news is that all of these guys seem to be, both the Tower of Hanoi and in the Tower of Brahma, they seem to be looking at a stack of 64 disks. Okay, so you really have to hope that these priests are really old, you know, and that they're moving slowly, because if they move very fast, the world will end fast. Okay, the question is, how long will it take for the world to end if they are solving this problem according to these rules? That's the reason, you know, it came into popular culture. But it's also a computer science problem. You should be able to come up with a program to solve this problem. Okay. Can somebody actually think of how to solve this for two disks exactly? Yeah. If you just have to do two disks, if I only have two disks and I'm trying to solve it, how do I solve it? Okay, here is big, here is small. And how do I mean, I can use the middle disk, remember, okay? I can use the middle disk to park myself. But even in the middle disk, I cannot put large on top of small. So here is a disk large, and here is disk small, and here is an empty peg, and here is the peg in which all of them have to go. Obviously, I can only pick one at a time, right? And now, of course, I can do the following thing. I can do this and put it here. Then what do I do with this one? I can't directly put it there, right? So you can obviously see this. You're all kids. You know, as kids, you must have played this kind of game. All you need to do is, does anybody have any idea to solve this? Yes. So small one in the middle, large one here, and then small one back here. How many moves did we make? Three. Turns out, 3 has a nice property. For two disks, 3 can be written as 2 power 2 minus 1. Why is that important? Because try to do this for 3 disks. And most of you will lose interest after 3 disks, because by the time 4 disks, if you do 3 disks, in essence, you know, I mean, I'll leave it up to you to, you know, simulate it in your mind, you know, after the class. When you do it for 3 disks according to these rules, then in essence you recursively solve the 2 problem and then the 3 problem. And the number of moves you make would be 2 power 3 minus 1. It's only 7 moves. Now for the good question, if we do have 64 disks, and we have really, you know, these priests have been practicing, they've been going to gym every day, etc. Okay, and you come up with a reasonable number for how much time they take to pick a disk while chanting, put it on another disk. Okay, you can try to compute how much time it will take. They will have to do 2 power 64 minus 1 moves. And even if these are Superman-like, you know, priests, Okay, even if you give very small numbers per move, you can compute how much time it takes. And for most reasonable numbers of heavy duty Superman freeze, it will still take more time than probably the universe will survive. So you are not particularly worried about universe ending on the count of these freeze. Okay? But more interestingly, the reason this problem is of interest to me in this discussion is, if I give you a Tower of Hanoi problem with k disks, you do know that the correct solution would be of size 2 power k minus 1 moves. So how long do you think in the worst case you will need to check whether the solution I gave you is correct? 2 power k minus 1. Do you understand what I'm saying? So suppose I, you know, like if I'm a bad teacher and I didn't think much and I gave you a problem which requires 28 pages of work, then what do? I say goodbye to my weekend because I have to look at everybody's 28-page solution to see if they have gone wrong anywhere. Okay? Which is why we have invented multiple choice questions where, you know, P equal to NP, yes or no. And it doesn't really matter whether you just, you know, flipped a coin or whether, you know, you really knew what you're talking about. But in general, if the solution is long, checking the solution would be is going to be proportional to the size of the solution. And the Tower of Hanoi problem is one problem you have heard of. There are many, many such problems in the world, but it's one problem that you heard of. You can write a little program for this. All of you can write a program to solve this problem. It's not hard at all. In fact, Tower of Hanoi is also used to motivate recursive programming. You know how many, you all said you know programming, right? You know recursion. It turns out recursive programming is the best way to write a solution for Tower of Hanoi. Okay, and it turns out that even though the program looks deceptively simple, you know, a few lines long, you give it 64, you can basically go to Africa and come back and it'll still be running. Okay, and so here is a problem where if you have this problem, you can look at your boss in the eye and say, look, I gave an exponential solution, there's no way you can do any better than exponential solution. Because the solution length itself is exponential. And just checking it will take exponential time. Okay? And now, of course, the harder problem, which we will probably get back next class, is if it is an NP, trying to show that it's still quite hard to solve is the harder problem. And to do that, you have to say that your problem is similar to some problem that all these people tried to solve, and they still couldn't do it in polynomial time. Okay? That's my last slide for today. And it turns out that if you have a class of NP problems and a class of P problems, there is a subset of NP problems called NP complete problems. Think of these as the monsters of the NP world. Okay? These are the hardest of the problems in class NP. And they have the property essentially that they are NP complete in the sense any other problem in NP can be polynomially reduced to this problem. What that means informally is if somebody wrote a program to solve one of these in polynomial time, then your problem also can be solved in polynomial time because you can write one program which converts your problem into his problem in polynomial time. And then that guy will solve his problem in polynomial time. A polynomial times polynomial is still a polynomial. X power 7 times x power 9 is x power 16. Right? Polynomials have this very beautiful property that if you multiply them, they'll still be polynomial. And the interesting question, of course, is if I can somehow find at least one problem and show that it is at least as hard as every other NP problem, then I'm in business. Then all I need to do is, there is, let's say, I have a set of NP complete problems I know because I read in the book, and my boss gave me a problem to solve. I then show that my problem can be polynomially reduced to one of the problems in this pink circle, a pink ellipse. Then I can tell my boss essentially that look, nobody has been able to prove P equal to NP, And if P is not equal to NP, this part is the hardest of the NP problems. And the fact that I couldn't solve it in a, you know, polynomial time, you should not be unhappy about it. That's what is NP complete. And that's why P and NP equal to NP question is very important, because if in fact P, as long as P is not equal to NP, this is the picture you have. People believe that P is not equal to NP. In fact, our whole entire lives now depend on P not being equal to NP. Unfortunately, we have been unable to prove it. Okay? Sometimes you want the problems to be hard to solve. For example, entire cryptography is based on the fact that factorizing large numbers is an NP-complete problem. And so we assume that anybody trying to crack our secrets will take a large amount of time. But if in fact P equal to NP, that means somebody from Mars knows how to write a program to solve, you know, factorization in polynomial time, and then you have to reinvent cryptography. Okay? So that's where we will stop. We'll do a little more on this next class and then go on to a slightly different topic. Okay? Thanks. Get your sleep for coming to class. Get your sleep for coming to class.